Welcome to the Imperial Security Bureau podcast, where we interview leaders in cybersecurity. Today, we have an awesome guest. I'm so excited. Richard Ford, a seasoned CTO in the cybersecurity space. Let's visit his LinkedIn real quick. He is a top team leadership voice. He lives in Austin, Texas, seasoned guy, a lot of knowledge, great in terms of leadership advice, leadership strategy. I can tell why people love to work for him. He's not at Petrorian right now. We're actually catching him at just the right moment. He's in between jobs right now, so he's kind of a free agent. He's able to talk to me. And if you're on the market for a talented CTO with great leadership and seasoned experience in the cybersecurity space, look no further than Richard. He has been a CTO for several tech startups in the cybersecurity space. He served as a chief scientist, and he's also a PhD in physics from the University of Oxford. We'll learn how he got into cybersecurity. I mean, the man has 30 patents in the cybersecurity space. How cool is that? He's also a big writer. If you want to check out some of his articles that he posts on LinkedIn, I'm excited to talk to Richard. Here we go. Welcome to the podcast, Richard.
Thanks, Blake. Thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
I want to give you the warm-up question here. What's your favorite Star Wars movie or show, and why?
So it's got to be The Wrath of Khan with Ricardo Montalban.
There she is. The Wrath of Khan.
Sorry, I just wanted to see your face when I did that, and you held your expression really well. I love that piece of bait. Star Wars fans can never resist it. There's a reason why I'm banned from most Star Wars forums. No, okay, serious answer. I still remember going to see the very first Star Wars movie, A New Hope. And I remember I saw it in the theater. I was a young'un at that point, so I was taken by somebody's parents. And I just remember being blown away at this world that had been created. I mean, it was the first sort of footsteps into the Star Wars universe, and it just blew my mind. And I can still remember being in the queue and the excitement. I was in England growing up, and it just blew me away. And I still have a very soft spot for that movie in my heart.
Very cool. Yeah, me too. It's got a lot of fans. And I find that almost everyone in cybersecurity loves Star Wars. It goes hand in hand. I don't know why.
Yeah, I've got a good friend who has a backdrop very much like yours with some of the pictures and gels from the show. And yes, it is a common theme.
Yeah. Well, I've seen, if you go on YouTube, you can find Star Wars man caves with much better deals than mine. Mine's below average compared to some folks, but yeah, I do love this stuff. So what's your story, man? I saw you had a PhD in physics. So how did you land the CTO role in the cybersecurity space?
Yeah, it's been a long journey. Back in the day, I was a musician and we had a really good band. I was at the University of Oxford doing my bachelor's. And so we decided to keep the band together, which meant the easiest way to do that was to all get PhDs. So off I went into the PhD program so I could keep playing music. And at the end of it, I got really into computing because we had an experiment. It was difficult to run, very manual for data analysis. And because it used a lot of power, we had to run it from 7 at night to 7 in the morning. And it had to be supervised, right? So what we would do is we'd spend all night working and then all day analyzing the data. So I don't like this plan. Felt a lot like hard work. And so I automated the data analysis, so analyzed the data while the experiment was running. That got me heavily into computing. And from there, it was the early days of computer viruses. And one morning I turned on my computer and it sort of said some rude things to me in Spanish on the screen and then proceeded to sort of lobotomize itself by wiping part of the drive. And so I'd always liked computing. So instead of just throwing my hands up in horror and giving up, I disassembled the virus and wrote a little article on it. That article got picked up by a company called Virus Bulletin, and they called me in to meet. And I never looked back. That was my entree into the world of computer security. And I've absolutely loved this topic ever since. Getting into the management of it, I'm really a technician at heart. I mean, I still code. You know, my idea of a good day is when I can actually fire up an IDE and write some code. But as a coder, it's frustrating sometimes because you can't see your ideas through to completion. And so you tend to sort of keep looking for more responsibility, and eventually you end up in this C-suite. And you discover that you don't actually still have the control that you thought you did. There are all other kinds of constraints up there.
Yeah, I hear about them all the time. Not as easy as it, you make it look, right? I also noticed that you're a LinkedIn top voice for leadership. Can we chat about content for just a second? Do you have like a content strategy that you follow that's working?
I don't know if I have a content strategy. I think I've been gifted with two things. I love people and I love writing. Right. So there's a really interesting book by, I think it's William Zinser, called Writing to Learn. And what he talks about is that you don't write to produce an article at times. If you want to learn something and really master it, write about it, because it forces you to get your thoughts straight. And so this combination of really loving people and really like writing means that I enjoy writing about leadership. I enjoy writing about pretty much anything. If you go onto my LinkedIn, you'll see there's a number of sort of long form articles that I've written over the last, I don't know, 5-10 years. And I just enjoy it. And I think when you're doing what you love, it all comes very naturally. This is one piece of career advice that I think people don't give out enough, which is do what you love and success tends to follow. So I'm not forcing it with a content strategy. I'm really just going, I love to write and I love to share some of the experiences I've had with people.
Well, it looks authentic. It doesn't look like something that ChatGPT just spit out for you. So, I mean, I really appreciate that.
It's interesting that you mentioned ChatGPT, because it sort of gets into this whole concept that Zinser had of writing to learn. So if you're a master at a subject, using ChatGPT is a great way to go faster. But if you're trying to learn a topic, you have to be very careful how you use tools like that. It doesn't mean you can't use them, but you have to use them mindfully. So if, for example, you struggle with writing, getting ChatGPT to do all your writing, maybe you get your deliverable done, but you're going to miss out on some of the other parts of the process and miss out on building that skill set too.
Right. It's kind of a cheat code and a crutch.
It can be. I mean, it's been incredibly helpful to some of the developers that I've worked with, but what I found is the more experienced the developer, the more they can benefit from these large language models, because they don't need to practice writing loops or, you know, iterating through something. That's just boilerplate. But if you don't have those concepts down and you're using sort of something to support you, I think that's when life gets a bit more complex.
Yeah. And I want to dive into AI a lot. And we'll definitely get into that. But I was wanting to chat a little bit, because I noticed on your LinkedIn, I mean, you've been researching malware prevention, I mean, since the mid-90s. I'm just curious, in your opinion, how has malware changed over the years? And what are some of the more modern concerns that you have about malware?
Well, let me start by a back at your question, Blake. Okay. First piece of ransomware. Is ransomware a new problem?
I guess it's not. It's probably been around for 30, 40 years.
Yeah, exactly right. So one of the first pieces of malware that was around was called the AIDS 2 Trojan diskette. And what it did, it was on these floppy disks, and this guy literally mailed them to people, and you had to put them in your drive and run it, and then eventually it would ransomware your computer, and you had to, by letter, reach out and pay him and all this. It was like total old school ransomware. So in substance is the word, it hasn't changed at all, right? It's the same stuff. In other ways, it's changed dramatically, because we have a lot of organized crime in there now. We have the scale of the internet, which means that everything's faster, better, cheaper when you're an attacker. And so in some ways, it's all stayed the same. In other ways, it's a much nastier threat environment. And the challenge is that the constant is that people are people, right? If I leave a USB drive with a file called salaries.xlsx, out near the door where all the smokers like to cluster on their lunch break, I guarantee that file will get opened. Everyone loves salaries.xls, right? Everyone reads it, and bam, now I can ransomware their computer potentially. And so, you know, the unchanging factor of people, all the old tricks still work. We just dress them up with more software. And the internet, rampant connectivity, it makes it easier for the attacker and sort of harder for the human.
Well, what are you focused on lately in your cybersecurity career? I mean, what's on the forefront of your mind?
One of the things I struggle with, Blake, is I find everything interesting. So, you know, it's like, find me a problem in cyber that I'm not enjoying. But what I've been doing in the last month or so is looking at phishing as a problem set. And what I've started to discover is all these free things you can get on the internet. So you can get free hosting, you can get free domain names, you can get free email, you can get free servers actually in the cloud by trials if you have a working email address, and those are free too. So there's this whole free ecosystem that the bad guys are using to attack us with phishing. And so most recently, I've been looking at phishing sites, playing with some phishing sites, and then seeing how I can couple some of that with large language models. So can I leverage some of the Gen AI stuff to do a little bit more analysis for me so I can do automation and try and deal with things more quickly? But the fascinating thing for me is having my eyes opened to this sort of free tier ecosystem of all the things you can get on the internet for free. And in fact, I'm working quietly on a paper, which at some point I'll publish, called, you know, I became a phishing master for the price of a can of Pringles, and I did need something to snack on while I was doing it. But it's crazy what you can get for free. You know, like even Azure, if you sign up, you can get quite a lot of free things from Azure. Same for GCP. Most of the clouds are the same. Everyone wants to give you a free trial. And then you can do all kinds of chaos from there.
Well, they're taking full advantage. Did you see the 60 Minutes interview? It's like they're worried the investigators have found that ransomware attacks could get even worse because the young Western hackers are joining forces with the Russian hackers.
I do have it recorded. I just haven't gotten around to watching it yet because it wasn't that long ago. But I read the story, and I do expect these things to get worse, right? But that's kind of how the pendulum works. What happens is this is effectively a zero-sum game between attackers and defenders. And when a problem gets bad enough, we address it in the right way, and then it gets kind of pushed back. So we reach this sort of unsteady equilibrium where nobody's getting hurt too badly, but people on the bad side are still winning quite a bit. And I think reimagining computer security, so you want to talk about things that get me excited, reimagining computer security where we don't play that stupid game anymore and where we can actually go for the brass ring and start locking this stuff down, that's something that I get really excited about. I'm tired of just sort of making things sort of not quite bad enough, if that makes sense. You know, we sort of get it, we never really fix anything, we just get it so it doesn't kind of suck too bad.
Put a Band-Aid on it.
Yeah, exactly. And it would be nice to get out of that world and get into a world where we can really let computing be the great sort of lift up for mankind that it could be, as opposed to sort of what it is right now, where I think we struggle a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I saw that article and I'm like, man, that's crazy. They're going to get in trouble for domestic terrorism or whatever. And then at the same time, I was like, man, there probably are a lot of just really upset. They said it was a younger generation, like 16 to 25.
So if you look at how, especially males, mature ethically, because they lag behind the girls a little bit, if you actually look at some of the studies. What you'll find is, it was like the early days of virus riders. These kids will age out, as they grow up and they go, you know, helping ransomware that hospital was probably a bad thing, right? Yeah. You know, because their technical skills outstrip their ethical knowledge. And if you were 16 and somebody was offering you decent sums of money to sort of use your skills for bad, not good, you know, I get why that's tempting. It's a problem. And I think, especially going back to AI, as we see disruptions in the marketplace, these disruptions can have these second order effects that can help drive more instability. So I think we're going to live through some interesting years.
Yeah, I also saw another article that bot-generated web traffic is about to surpass human-generated web traffic. Like, what's up with that?
That doesn't surprise me in the least. So looking at some of these phishing sites, obviously I've got my own little bot that looks at phishing sites for me, because there are many and it takes too long, so why automate it? So I'm definitely part of that problem of crawling the web and looking at
things. You contributed.
Yeah, exactly right. But I think it's not really a surprise. If you think about how people use the web, in fact, they tend to skip along the surface. I don't know if you've seen some of these eye tracker studies. So you can get an eye tracker for a computer and it'll show you where your eyes are on a website. And when you look at these, you can see how little we actually take in of all the content that's there. Whereas a bot, it's just going to scrape the whole website. So yeah, there's a lot of bottage going on.
So let's go ahead and talk about AI. Are you really using AI for either writing code or in any specific way?
Yeah, absolutely. I think anybody who's a good programmer who isn't using Gen AI to make themselves more productive was missing a trick. With writing, I actually really enjoy writing. So when it comes to writing, what I do with AI sometimes is say, when I'm struggling with a sentence or a paragraph, I'll ask the AI to give me some different ideas, rewrite the sentence or rewrite this paragraph to make it more coherent. The other thing that I found is really good with AI is a prompt that says, tell me all the reasons that this paragraph might be wrong or incorrect. What haven't I thought about? So you get it to disagree with you rather than to sit there and tell you you're wonderful. And that, so it becomes either very Socratic or sort of very annoying, depending on your personality. But I found getting AIs to disagree with me, tell me all the reasons why what I've written here might be wrong.
Hmm.
That can be quite good fun. And as a developer, sure. You know, when I'm writing code, I'm dramatically faster when accompanied by an AI. And I don't view it as that different from popping out to Stack Overflow and going, remind me how to access, you know, how to do upserts in SQLite, you know, because it's got a bit of a funky syntax. I always forget it.
Right.
It's the same thing. When it becomes a problem is when it stops you learning, right? So if it's writing code that I don't fully grok, I use the time I save to make certain that I really understand the new concepts in code that sometimes the AI will pull in for me. And I don't use it for really complex things. I tend to use it for the boilerplate. Give me a class that's a singleton in Python. Okay, great. Thank you, AI. That saved me, you know, having to remember and get it wrong twice.
Yeah, it's an interesting approach there because I haven't thought of that. Like, I've asked it to help me write marketing emails, and what it comes back with, I find, is just too wordy for me. It's like, I just don't like it. I like to be short and sweet, get my point across in as few words as possible, because I know that people read their emails like text messages, right? If it's too long, they're not going to read it. But I've never thought about feeding it what I would want to say, what I'd want to email, and asking it, what's wrong with what I've written here? Why do you think someone wouldn't reply to this? I'm going to actually do that.
How could you make this better is another, right. You know. And again, it comes down to this book by Zinsser. This book is a game changer for me, Writing to Learn. When you write, you learn something. You don't want to cede that to the machine. You don't want to give that away. But what you have to do to be competitive is to figure out how to use those machines to make you faster while still getting the cognitive plus up of thinking something through. When you think about a marketing email, or when you think about how can I best serve my clients, right? Because that's really sometimes what that email is about. It's like, how can I explain to you how I can best serve you? If you get a machine to do that, it doesn't become part of you. It's just like, I will squirt out this email and we're done. Whereas if you roll around in it for a little bit, maybe you're slower, but it becomes more woven through who Blake is. And so it's a very delicate balancing act. I'm definitely not a Luddite when it comes to this stuff. But I also think we live in a world where the tool changes the tool user, right, as well. So tools work both ways, right? We use the tool to do what we want, and the tools also change us. And I think it's very important to recognize that. That's one of the reasons why when I have the chance to do focus work, I use the Pomodoro technique, if you've come across it, because I find it really forces me to focus on the tasks at hand and be very much in that flow state at all times.
Can you tell us more about that approach? Who'd you say it was?
It's the Pomodoro technique. It comes from literally those little Pomodoro kitchen timers, you know, the red tomato that ticks and rings that you'll see in your mom's kitchen. What it does is you essentially work on a single task for the duration of one Pomodoro. And generally people say 25 minutes, but that duration is whatever you want it to be. And you don't change tasks when you're within that focus period. And during that focus period, it's 100% effort. Your phone rings, you don't pick it up. Your Slack goes, you ignore it, you know, the whole thing. And what I find is It's grueling. It's hard to do more than 50 hours a week if you're doing strict Pomodoros. But what you'll get accomplished and how you prioritize your tasks when you do it rigorously is, for me at least, a game changer. If you look at your computer, it's a distraction machine, right? It's designed to distract you. Same with your phone. So you probably did what I did when you were setting up for this. I turned off all notifications on my desktop. My phone is on Do Not Disturb and on silent, sort of the double whammy. The only person it would ring for is my wife, and she's just in the other room, so I know she's not going to call me. But coping well in those high distraction environments is really important. And for me, Pomodoro time management, and you'll find a lot of developers do this, is a very effective technique for managing my time.
If you can stay disciplined to it, yes, it is. And it's the only way to go. But yeah, you're right. It's distraction city when you're sitting in front of, especially multiple screens. And you know, you got your little screen there in front of you. Mm-hmm. I know you got the notifications turned off, but man, it's notification city. And it's hard to like turn, especially as a recruiter, because I'm always like waiting on somebody to get back to me, mm-hmm. or, you know, waiting on some news, waiting on feedback, and waiting on an interview request. And I really just need to be aware of the notifications, right? I can't turn them off. I need them. So as a recruiter, it's hard not to get distracted. You're just like going all over the place all day. So you got to get up early, get your busy work done early or after the workday, because in the middle of the workday, you just kind of have to let it take you.
Yeah, no, it's tough. It's funny that you said something interesting. It's like, if you stay disciplined. And I was talking to a friend, I guess sort of a mentee, and we were talking about these sort of disciplines. He says, yeah, you know, whenever I get really busy and I'm sort of really behind, I start doing all my disciplines again. And I said, but think about it. The reason you're behind is because you stopped. And then you get disciplined and you dig your way out of the hole and everything's good. And then you stop doing it. It's been like dieting, right? You diet, you lose 15 pounds. You're like, whoa, I have a beer or whatever your thing is. And you put it back on. The time you need these disciplines is before you're in trouble, not after. When it really becomes, I get up in the morning and this is how I do it, it becomes a game changer. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really hard. Discipline is like something I fight with all the time. You know, I think everybody does, but it's like when you disappoint yourself because you didn't do the thing that you told yourself you needed to do, like spend an hour and a half doing whatever this task is, or getting up at a certain time, or going to bed at a certain time. When you're looking for a reason to not do the thing, all you need is one. And yes. it's just tough, man. So the discipline part is the hardest thing. You seem to have a lot of wisdom on this. I guess, do you have any daily routines or habits that you feel like have led to your success?
Oh my God, Blake. Hell yes. So I literally have two checklists that I use every day. One is when I first sit down to my computer, there's a checklist that I go through, and there's a special one for Mondays of that I also do. And it's like, here are the most important things, get my task list, figure out what I want to accomplish today, blah, 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 blah. And at the end of the day, before I sign off from my computer, I also have a checklist with like simple and obvious things that really helps me. Like before I sign off from my computer, pull up your calendar for tomorrow and make certain you don't have a 6 a.m. meeting. Because I mean, I work with people all over the globe, right? So you never know when a meeting's going to come up. Have I completed all the things I committed to for people today before I sign off? And if the answer is no, either do them or send an email to that person and say, hey, I really wanted to get this done today. It's now on tomorrow. They don't take long to run, like 5 or 10 minutes. And for me, it's a game changer. I live and die by my task list. I think I've probably said to you on a call at some point, hey, Blake, I'm lying to you. If you don't see me write it down, I don't mean what I'm saying. Right. So when I commit to someone, the first thing you'll see me do is put it on my task list. And now the only way it can drop off that task list is by getting it done. I found having a morning and evening checklist feels really rigid, but it's actually, for me, it's a game changer and it makes me more reliable to my colleagues. And I think, especially in today's environment, that's a compliment you want from your coworkers is, man, if Richard says it, you can take it to the bank. Right? Because people often don't follow through on what they say they'll do. And I'm really big on that. I think it's how you develop trust.
Yeah. Especially with yourself, right? If you tell yourself, hey, I'm going to get up tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. I'm going to be in the 5 a.m. club. And if you hit the snooze, it may not be the worst thing ever, right? You just, maybe I get up, don't get up till 6:30, but I've disappointed myself and now it can start a snowball because I have these highs and lows, right? And as a reward for being disciplined for like 3 or 4 days, then I'll allow myself to be a piece of crap, stay up late, you know, eat junk food, the video games, but then I'll get back on track. It's kind of like with the reason that I do OMAD fasting. It's because I'm terrible at being disciplined about what I eat when I'm hungry. I'm just going to eat whatever's there, whatever's available in the kitchen, my kids' leftovers, whatever. But I can manage to just not eat all day until dinner. But if I'm like feeling like I've overdone it with maybe alcohol or had an eventful weekend where a bunch of hot dogs and hamburgers and french fries and stuff, then I'll fast for, I'll have like a 2-day or 3-day fast to make up for it. So I feel like I'm always in this cycle of discipline followed by a period of reward and I get to be undisciplined. Do I really want every day to be the same? Because I kind of like that. I like every day to be kind of different. So I'm in a struggle with that right now.
I think we're sometimes too hard on ourselves, right? I mean, the trick is, I always remind myself, I am either up or getting up. I'm never down, right? So I'm either up or getting up. And you know how it is with gyms, right? You miss a day and then you miss a week. That's crazy. It's like, you missed a day, big whoop. My gym streak is gone. Doesn't matter. I'm up or getting up. I'll do it tomorrow. It's fine.
There's just don't miss 2 days in a row, right? Just don't
miss, or even if something happens and you do, don't miss three. People live in the past. You can't look in the rearview mirror and let those failures define tomorrow. You have to look at the cards that are in your hand right now and play the very best card that you can. You cannot go, I wish I'd drawn an ace last time. It's pointless. Ray Dalio, in his book Principles, which for me is, it's a fantastic book. I recommend it to anybody who wants to really get straight with the universe. One of the things he says all the time is accept reality and deal with it. So in your habit case, the reality is maybe you had an extra drink last night or I skipped the gym for 2 days. Accept reality, it is what it is, and deal with it. So I'll go today. I am either up or getting up and accept reality and deal with it. I think you could build a pretty good life around just those two expressions. People try and do too many things. Just wire something simple like accept reality and deal with it into your psyche and go.
There's an expression that my brother told me the other day. If you're married, you understand. But I know he said if you're either up or you're getting up. Well, his thing was, as a married man, you're either in trouble or just getting out of trouble. It's only two modes. Yes,
that resonates with me. And bluntly, Blake, most of the time, I probably deserve it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I've been a piece of crap. Only time will heal this. Just got to wait for it to blow over. All right. Back to AI. What are we going to do when AI takes all the jobs?
I don't think it's going to take all the jobs. I love the way you asked that question. But I do think that this will be a bit like the Industrial Revolution. So I've studied the Industrial Revolution at length because I think past is prologue. If you want to understand, if you want to predict the future, you better know the past. So what was the Industrial Revolution? One way of thinking about the Industrial Revolution is it was physical automation, right? So suddenly we had factories, we had, you know, steam trains. We were automating the physical tasks and that created a lot of jobs and it destroyed a lot of jobs. And in fact, we could talk for hours on the second order effects of the Industrial Revolution. What we're seeing with AI is some level of cognitive automation, right? So you can think of it almost as it's going to be a similar revolution, but it makes us much more uncomfortable because cognition has sort of been the sort of sacred spot, right? It's the thing that the machines didn't take away from us. And I think there's a lot of fear around this. And I think some of it is justified. And I think a lot of it is unjustified. The trick is going to be how these tools get matured, how they get adopted. So we're all familiar with the Gartner hype cycle. We're definitely at the peak of inflated expectations, you know, and about to head down into the trough of disillusionment. But the other side of the trough of disillusionment, you will see serious serious implications. And the thing with the Industrial Revolution is it was very difficult to predict the outcome, you know, what the ultimate societal effects of that revolution would be. You wouldn't foresee that that would lead to the creation of slums. And at some level, some people would even argue the disparity between genders in terms of pay. And it's crazy. You know, it's very hard to see these second order effects. And that's what we're going to deal with AI. There'll be the on the surface effects, and then there'll be second order effects that sometimes are more societally impacting that are difficult to predict. And as historians, we fall for what's called the narrative fallacy. A lot of the time, that means history makes sense. Like, oh, it was predictable that the Industrial Revolution would lead to the creation of the inner city. It makes sense because you're viewing it backwards, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I'm really afraid. I mean, I'm afraid. I feel like we should just stop. We just cancel it. Let's not do this. We actually need people to do these jobs. No AI. The people that do get laid off, right? They're going to try to reinvent themselves or find the cracks where AI is not playing in that space and try to solve a problem there. But we're dealing with something that you're only going to have a small window of time before an AI technology takes that idea too, right? So any startup idea, you're kind of at risk because you're going to sink a bunch of time and energy into something that probably AI is going to do later.
Maybe. I think what we have to do is think about how can we use AI as an enabler rather than as a replacer, right? So many years ago, I managed to sever my Achilles tendon. 0 stars, do not recommend, right? But then I promise this story is going somewhere. I got a boot, right? One of those, you know, those big gray boots that they make you walk around with that I used a lot as I slowly started to learn to walk again. And that was, it was a physical prosthesis, if you like. Didn't walk for me, but it helped me walk. I think that the opportunity with AI is how can we use AI to unleash our ideas and our creativity rather than replace our ideas and our creativity. And I think it's not clear how we as a species will sort of deal with that, right? So that's where the fear comes from. But I think there's an opportunity for this to be a great unleashing of creativity. I have a friend, Justin. Hi, Justin, if you're watching this, who's doing the most amazing things with AI right now, making videos, right? And they're really, really cool. He's using AI to generate characters and, you know, to read his script. He's a former filmmaker, really smart guy, love him to pieces. And he's using AI not to go, oh, I'll never be able to, you know, make this moving picture thing again. He's using AI to go, I can realize my dreams by leveraging AI. So when we put it in the box of how do we use this as a prosthesis rather than a replacement, I think it can get exciting. Now, where you get nervous, I'm sure, is you're thinking, okay, Richard, how utopian of you. The big corporations will just go, oh, I can take my workforce from 10,000 to 1,000. And I do think we need to think about that. And like all revolutions, it will happen faster than we think and more slowly than we think, both at the same time.
Interesting. I don't know, man. It's like in the movie Dune, or the story of Dune, in the history of the Dune universe, right? They destroyed all the AIs, made them illegal. We all look to the sci-fi movies to anticipate what's going to happen. And, you know, whether it be Terminator or the friendly bot that helps you in your kitchen, still, it's like there's always the opportunity for bad stuff. You know, I try not to be a pessimist about it, but I'm like always looking for what's wrong. That's where my mind goes. You're an optimist. I can tell you're an optimist, and you'd be great to work for. I know why you have the leadership badge, because you can reframe those thoughts into something positive, where I'm like going to negative town.
So take what you do, Blake. Think about, is there anything you could do with AI that would unleash your creativity and ability to help your clients and job seekers? Are there ways that you could use that to make the world better? And that the reason I'm an optimist is I believe that, and I challenge people to create the future that you want to see. Don't sit there and go, oh, this is going to be terrible. Get involved. The future doesn't create itself. We create it. For the longest time, the wallpaper on my laptop was be the change you want to see in the world. And it wasn't just there as a slogan. It really was there to remind me every time I get on my computer, how can I change the world to be more like the world I want it to be?
Yeah, that's the only way. I love that quote, by the way. Can companies automate their whole cybersecurity process with AI? Do you feel like that's going to happen in the next few years?
Not yet, but they can use AI to help them. I think that comes with some risks. You have to look at cybersecurity as a zero-sum adversarial game. That means, you know, to put it simply, whatever I do, the attackers make a counter move. So if I put up a 10-foot fence around my property, the attackers will go and buy 12-foot ladders, right? I mean, that's kind of how it works. So using AI today, if you're a defender, I think can be quite effective. And I think, and by the way, you already are. AI has been used in cybersecurity for years and years and years and years and years. It's just, it hasn't had the hype around it, right? If you use any antivirus, there's some form of neural network or something going back in its creation, right? You don't deal with that kind of data without dealing with, you know, some sort of machine learning. And so you're already using it. Automating your whole defensive infrastructure, I don't think so in the near future, but I do think we'll have security co-pilots that sort of help us sort of make better decisions. And I think the only risk with that is when it's a battle of the bots, machine versus machine, that's where being a completely irrational actor can sort of pay dividends. There's a sci-fi book. I know you're a keen fan of sci-fi, and I keep trying to look up the author. Maybe somebody who listens to this can tell me which book this was, because I remember reading it. It's about a guy, he's flying around in a starfighter, and he just gets sick of life. So he turns off his AI, thinking, I will be killed. And he's flying in a straight line in the battle, and nobody can hit him, because they're all using AIs to predict where he's going to be. And the last place they're predicting is that he'll be flying straight and level. So I believe that our jobs as creators is to change the rules of the game whenever we can. And so AI is exciting to me because it lets me change the rules of the game. And then when everyone's using it, maybe there are some things I can do by not using it that change the rules of the game in certain places. You want to be different at the end of the day. There's a lot of ways that you can approach the problem that give you a uniqueness that's kind of fun.
Yeah, AI can't generate a podcast as interesting as this one that you and I are having, right? That's impossible. We have to do that.
Absolutely right, Blake. Unfortunately, I'm going to say can't generate it yet. You know, where this is going to go is really unclear to me. And I think that anybody that tells you they know where it's going to go is full of it. The rate of advancement that we're seeing right now is pretty stellar. And I don't know where it stops. And I don't know how we decide to harness that power for good and not for evil. And I think if you look at us again as a species, we're not generally very good about harnessing things for good, not evil. So that's where thinking people need to get involved, right? Again, this isn't happening to us. We're building a future. Let's build the one we want.
Yeah, we're doing this. So a little bit about the 2024 job market. There's a lot of tech companies that I see, they're cutting costs, and big enterprise companies are cutting out middle management, and they're trying to reduce costs and bureaucracy and be more agile. As your role as a CTO, right, you've built organizations before. How much org chart cutting can you make happen and still function properly?
I've got friends who have like a million direct reports right now who are bleeding out of the eyeballs because they can't backfill that middle layer. I think it's a cycle, I suspect. I think that we have got a little bit bloated in the tech space. Everyone was used to sort of jackpot salaries and, you know, I will hop jobs every 2 years and I will get a 20% raise plus a signing bonus, blah, blah, blah. And what you're seeing is classic economy. It's an overcorrection. I think what we're going to do is swing too far the other way. And eventually, if we're lucky, we'll find that happy medium. And so As somebody in the tech space, I think it's just a cycle. We've seen cycles before. We'll see cycles later, especially in cyber. Cyber's going to be a thing in 5 years. It's not going to go away. I think good people management, that's never going to get replaced by a machine. You started this conversation by pointing out that I think I had a leadership top voice. Note it's not a management top voice, because those are two very different things. And I think leadership is very hard to automate. Management can be a bit more process oriented. Leadership is about, how do I grab this person's heart, right? If you grab their heart, their head will follow. You can motivate someone with their head briefly, but if you capture that heart, they're motivated forever.
Very well said. I've never heard anyone say that. Good job, man. Yeah, I need to work on my own leadership abilities because I'm always like trying to find the process, right? What's the routine? How can I be a better manager? Well, there's like a daily routine and the habits and the biweekly one-on-ones and the form I'm going to fill out. You should forget all that.
I think like the first thing I would do is separate leadership and management in your brain because you need to do both. Right. If you just lead and don't manage, you're going to leave this trail of highly, highly devoted chaos behind you. And if you just manage, you won't retain people and you'll never get people to the level that they could be gotten to. What you need to do is both. So I think it's awesome that you're trying to manage your team. You also need to lead your team. There's a good book by Simon Sinek. Well, there's a lot of good books by Simon Sinek.
I mean, yeah, he's good.
Start with Why is a good one. But the one I'm thinking about right now is Leaders Eat Last. It talks a lot about leadership and leadership skills. And I found it in my career very, very helpful. I wish somebody had given it to me years and years ago because it makes it very clear about the difference between managing something, which is important, and leading a group of people. Because management can be done by fear or by authority. Leadership is much more complicated. You don't even need a title to be a leader. Anyone can do it.
Yeah. So we work on a lot of roles for companies that are a manager position, director position, even some VP roles. Clients asking for the hands-on player coaches that can still code. And you're an anomaly, Richard. You're a CTO who codes, right? You don't see that very often. There's a debate, right? Because the candidate marketplace, they're like, oh my God. Well, if that's what they're asking for, then that's not me, right? I'm a leader. I'm a manager. Like, do they want a manager or do they want a developer? What I find, though, is whenever I do place someone who's the hands-on player coach in a management role, you know, we'll stay in touch. And then 60, 90 days later, I'll ask them, how much of your day-to-day is coding? How much hands-on are you doing? And they're like, no, you don't understand. This job is 140% management. I don't do any code. I don't have time for coding. So I just get irritated now every time I hear, you know, yeah, we want a hands-on player coach in the management role, because if you want that, you're not necessarily going to get the best leader, right?
I think it depends, right? So if that person was literally coding on the product, I think, yeah, they're probably getting overpaid to write code and it's not going to be the most effective use of their time. But I've always read those job descriptions, or at least interpreted them mentally, because maybe I'm putting them through a filter that makes sense to me, of I can sit down with those developers and help them. And that's what I've always done with the developers that have worked for me. I'm happy to sit down and we'll talk about the design pattern they need to use. I'm still quite good at being, even like, let me help you debug this. But I'm never going to sit down and write the code because I'd be the world's most expensive programmer. It's just a bad use of company money. So when I read player code, I always hope what the company really means is somebody who's technical enough to sit down with their team and really engage with them technically, rather than, and you will spend 50% of your time actually coding, because I feel like that's probably not ever going to be very efficient.
Think the same thing. But yeah, I mean, it's different. Like if you want somebody who has a coding background, okay, that's fair. That's doable. Like there's a lot of folks with that background. But if you want someone who is still writing a lot like lines of code and submitting them into production as of this month, and you're looking for a manager, director, or VP, I don't know. It's just,
yeah,
it's irritating.
I think as a manager, if you're doing PRs on a regular basis, something maybe is wrong with your org structure if it's a reasonably sized org. But I think it's very useful to have a manager who is capable of still doing those PRs and can still talk that talk in depth. And by the way, your team knows when you're BSing them. They know when you're no longer technically competent. If a lot of your job is doing those PRs, maybe that's not really that management role. But the fact that you're still wholly capable of doing those PRs and would love to if given the opportunity, I think that can actually be quite effective because people will follow someone like that. Knowing that your manager could roll up their sleeves and do your job can be really uplifting rather than crushing if they're a good manager, because that manager also can relate to you, who you are and what you're likely struggling with. And so you can become much more enmeshed in your team and respected by your team.
Yeah, respect.
It can work really well.
Yeah, we're managers in production at JobBot. So I always kind of question the advice and like the direction I get from leaders in the staffing world who aren't in production and haven't been in production for years. It's like, oh, okay, just make more cold calls. Okay. Yeah, I want you to work in my seat, do this job for a couple of months, and then I'll come visit you again and we'll look at your numbers.
I used to have a job, I won't name the company, going back a ways on my resume. It was a fairly senior job, but one day a month, I would go and handle tech support calls in the call center. And it kept, the team really liked it because I understood what they were dealing with. But B, it made me a much better leader because I now know what's the pain, what's the customer pain? And I'd spend the next 29 days making certain we address it and come back. I think, again, that sort of get in the trenches and see what the world's really like, you know, walk a mile in my shoes can be quite effective. Again, my boss at the time wasn't thrilled that I would wander over to support and plug myself in for an afternoon or a day. But for me, it was time very well spent.
And I'm sure you were able to provide some benefit from that, make some changes, make a lot of people's lives better by what you learned from that experience, right?
Yeah. What I would do is go back and instead of fighting fires the next 29 days, figure out how to make fire suppression systems. Because, you know, when you get the same call three times on one shift rotation, you know that this is a problem with your design and you can fix it. There's like nine layers of management between tech support and you. You don't hear those problems. By the time they get to your desk, they're not real. This is from Sinek's book, Leaders Eat Last. There's an example where he talks about making problems real and making them personal, where he looks at radiologists. And if a radiologist just has a little picture of their patient, as well as the X-ray or the CAT scan or whatever, guess what? They do a better job, which is shocking to me, right? After all that schooling. And it's just because now it's a little bit more personal. And so they go that extra mile. Same thing. When I've spoken to customers and heard their pain, I go back to my desk more incentivized to go, how can I really help that customer? And I think that's why having contact with your customers is so important. That's why, Blake, in your role, you're speaking to job seekers and you're speaking to hiring managers. And I think that keeps you very real in what's the pain on both sides. Because in this market, both sides are feeling some pain.
Oh, yeah, a lot. And you were talking about tech support. I wanted to just ask you this quick question because you might have a unique perspective of this being a, you know, CTO software companies, but you know, the tech support folks, you send a ticket in, hey, the software is not working. Mm-hmm. And you get the canned response every time. Clear your cache and your cookies and your browser history and log back in again. You know, if you hear that enough times, you start thinking like, wait a minute, is it possible to build software that can just, regardless of what the cookies and the browser's doing, just works? Or is it just too codependent?
That's a good question. There is some codependency in there. But I'll say in my professional history, whenever we would tell a user, go in and blow all their cookies away, I would also sit down with our team and say, why? It's not a reasonable ask. What can we do to reduce that friction? Even if it's because their browser did something crazy. Right? Are there things that I can do, that I can control, that will allow us to solve it on our side, even if it's not really our problem? I think that sort of really customer-centric, being crazy about taking care of your customers, is so important. And as companies grow, they stop doing that, right? When you're a tiny little startup and you call in and the guy who picks up the phone or the girl who picks up the phone is the CTO because they're one of the founders, that gets lost as the company grows. And I think it's a bad thing. And it's why companies lose the ability to innovate sometimes as they grow. And why it's a special company that can keep that really close connection to their customer. And I think that having that super customer-centric viewpoint in the world is something that's the recipe for making a great company. It's not about technology. It's about, are you looking after your people and are you looking after your customers? And if you're just obsessively focused on those two things, the tech kind of takes care of itself.
Well, I can tell you'd be great to work for, Richard. And if you scroll down on your LinkedIn profile, You've got some of the greatest like recommendations I've ever read. I mean, they're incredible. So kudos to you. I want to talk a little bit about employee retention. You know, how do you typically retain talent at your organization? Like what keeps engineers and the folks under you happy and engaged?
So I'll answer this generally. This is across all the companies I've worked with. I think there are two things. One of them is really hard medicine for managers to accept. And the other is just common sense. We'll start with the hard medicine. You shouldn't keep everyone, right? You can have a rising star who gets the dream job offer of their life from AWS or Google or Amazon. And the right advice sometimes for that rising star is you should go take that job. That is an amazing opportunity. I love you. You can come back when you're a VP. You know, it would be great. Because if you really get somebody to make the wrong decision for their career, they're not going to love you for it in the long run. Sometimes if you really love something, you got to let them go. And by the way, word gets around that the conversation was had and it was handled really well. And that only helps with retention. The other thing is if somebody's not succeeding, you know, it's not retention at any cost. Sometimes the best for you might be to be working somewhere else. So there's that. For employees that you want to retain and within your bounds of people that you can retain, i.e. they're a great fit for your culture, they're a great fit for the company, you need to keep challenging people. You can't retain people with money, right? It doesn't work, not in the long haul. You try and scratch that itch, you're going to bankrupt yourself, and you're not really going to make them happy. You got to figure out, what does this person really want? Do they want to learn? Do they like recognition? Do they like to see themselves advance? Advancement is important. If somebody sees how they can advance within your company, they'll very often stay. If somebody's learning and seeing new things, that's another good reason for people to stay. When it comes to cash comp, what I say is pay people well enough that you're competitive, so you take money off the table. Now let's have a conversation about the development of your career. And it's hard, right? Because I think sometimes there's this sense that we should retain all great talent. And I think in the long run, that can be a bit of a risky strategy. If somebody's been literally offered the dream job, maybe you just shake their hand and go, I can't compete with that. That's awesome. Let's stay in touch. I know it's kind of radical. A lot of people would be like, oh, Richard, you're a terrible manager for saying that. You're not looking out for the company. I think I am. I think word of that conversation gets around and people go, Richard's a real human being. He sees me as a person.
Yeah. I have heard you have to look at employees not like you own them forever. It's just that you're renting their help for a while. So keep that in mind.
That win-win. That's always what you want to look for, right? If you and I were ever negotiating a deal, you'd be sick of hearing me say, Blake, how can we find a win-win here? And what I mean by that is, how can you walk away going, man, I'm glad I did that. And I can walk away going, that was a great deal. Same with an employee, right? We don't own that employee. And bluntly, loyalty in companies is so often one way. We ask our employees to be loyal to us. And then the second something prettier or shinier comes along, they're out and somebody else is in. I mean, you've seen that happen in companies, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
We need to instead look for that win-win, where the employee is being built up and advanced and being treated well, and their career and long-term wellness and the whole person is being nurtured. And the company needs to be, you know, advancing and getting the things that it needs to be successful in the marketplace. And I think when we can get away from a purely transactional view and look for that win-win, that can be quite a good retention tool. And I find being able to have real conversations with your team is really healthy. Over my career, over many of the companies I've worked with, I've had instances where employees come into my office or said, hey, can we go get coffee? And they said, Rich, I'm thinking about leaving. And instead of ripping their head off or immediately doing succession planning, first thing I'll ask them is, what are you not getting? Let's have a real conversation. And I believe when you find the right thing for both of you, that's the sort of sweet spot. That's where you get the very best outcomes.
We always tell folks it's not a good idea to consider a counteroffer because of the stats, right? You're going to be gone in 6 months anyway. Empty promises, and you just shouldn't do it, right? Only 15-20% of the time it actually works out.
And it depends what you're counteroffering. If you counteroffer on comp, you're absolutely right. But if you counteroffer sometimes around role, things can work out quite differently. Oh, I didn't realize there was a way for me to get into project management or product management from there. That's right. Quite interesting, Richard. Tell me about it. But yes, if my counteroffer is, I will increase your salary by 20%, guess what? You're going to get the same card played on you in probably 6 months' time.
Yeah. I'm someone that a counteroffer did work on. So, you know, I'm part of the 15, 20%, but it is risky. I mean, anytime your boss gets mad at you for leaving, huge red flag. Like, you just validated my whole decision here. Like, yeah, I got to go. But I mean, your boss should be happy for you. Oh yeah. Tell me about the opportunity. That's awesome. I'm happy for you. I'm proud of you. And then maybe throw in, what if you could get that here?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'll ask, is there anything we could do to retain you? Is there anything different that we could have done that would have stopped this coming to a head? But at the end of the day, you got to look at what the offer is. And if it really is a better offer, it's okay. And your team, by the way, will go, oh, so you can go some really great places after you've been working here for 5 years. That's great. I'll tell my friends they should come here, you know, because it builds you up. And that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I always try to look at when folks are in offer situations. And, you know, it could be an offer from one of my clients, and then they might have a competing offer. I try to look at it from an unbiased lens and just try to treat that person like their personal friend or, you know, my own brother, and just look at, okay, well, tell me about, let's compare, like, let's talk about it. And if the other offer is arguably better for a lot of reasons, I'll just be honest. Hey, you know what? Can't fault you for that decision. I mean, yeah, that one's obviously better. I'll see if we can compete. If not, sounds like you've got the decision here. I'm not going to make them feel terrible over it.
Well, you know, that's smart, Blake. And because I know you like sci-fi, I'll pull an example from sci-fi. You might not remember this, but it's in Ender's Game. There's a scene where, you know, they're saying, Ender, why did you keep kicking him when he was down? And Ender said, you'd already won the fight. And Ender says, I wasn't trying to win this fight. I was trying to win all the fights. i.e. the future fights.
Right.
And by treating people well, I think you set yourself up very well for future transactions, right? And a future relationship, because people remember that.
They do. But everybody seems to be kind of stressed out right now about what's going on and everything. How do you typically deal with the stress of having the CTO job? It's a big job.
It is a big job. Friends are helpful. Disconnecting is actually really helpful. I try not to live on my cell phone. I give it 1,000% when I'm working and try and give it 0% when I'm not, because I think recharging the batteries is really important. I really like exercise, right? So tennis, walking, mountain biking, things that focus your mind on other things. And then be present in the moment, whatever it is you're doing. If you're watching a movie, watch the movie. If you're working, work. Don't half do things. Mindfulness is really important. And that helps me greatly with the stress. I mean, I'm very lucky. My wife is awesome. I can vent to her. She's really smart. So she knows what I do and the kind of tech that we work with. And so she's like a great co-pilot, where she's like, okay, just, why don't you just go for a walk? She knows me well enough that I'll be typing and I'll hear her yell from the other room, whatever email you're typing, don't send it. Go for a walk and then decide if you still want to send it when you come back.
Right.
If you can tell from how I'm punching the keys that it's not a good one to send.
Oh yeah. I've been guilty of sending some emails I shouldn't have sent.
Yeah, I think a healthy boundary, right, between life and work.
This causes a lot, you know, your cell phone. And saw some funny meme the other day. I did a good job on my medium screens today. So to reward myself, I'm going to watch my big screen while I hold my little screen. Yeah, so we're always in front of screens.
I joke with my wife, though, if we're watching a movie, I'll say, I'm going to go put my cell phone in jail. So I'll go put it in another room with the ringer off. And now she's got my attention. And it's really good. That's another thing about leadership, by the way, right? One of the nice things, we're recording this, so there's no room for me to be half listening, but all your meetings should be like this. If you're in a meeting with somebody and they're not giving you 100% of their attention, they shouldn't be taking that meeting, right? Be present in what you do and it will go a long way.
Very true. Yeah, I got to think about that with my kids. I got small kids, you know, 6 and 4, and this thing, I just got to put it on the charger
and stay present, because they're going to guard that. And suddenly they'll be 16 and 18 and you'll be like, ah.
Yeah. Yeah. Why didn't I hang out with you more when you wanted to hang out with me?
That's right.
Can we chat a little bit about what are your go-to sources of information when it comes to, you know, either cybersecurity threats or news related to the tech market? What do you follow?
Yeah, I get asked this question a lot, actually. It seems like it's a question that people like to ask. And my answer is there's no one person or one thing. I use a stream reader. I use Feedly. And I have a ton of feeds, RSS feeds, that it compiles for me. And part of my Monday, part of my checklist, we're talking about checklists earlier, is, you know, I start my day by looking at Feedly and looking not at one source of information, but at a lot of information, and then drill in. I'll usually try and pick two articles a day to drill into and read about. So I go pretty broad and I let my experience tell me what's interesting and jump into it. And you find things that way that you wouldn't normally see in the main news cycle.
I don't have an RSS feed type situation. Maybe I should learn how to do that. I'm just a YouTube junkie. My phone's constantly blowing me up about, you know, this podcast and that podcast and people I follow.
Yeah. I mean, there's some good quality content on there for sure. I'm always bumping into creators where I'm like, this girl's really smart, or this guy is really smart. And I like that. But again, for me, YouTube can be a bit undisciplined in terms of how I'm spending my time. So at least with my RSS feeds, it's a sort of more groomed collection of things that works for me.
What do you speculate might have happened between the board of OpenAI and Sam Altman to cause that ruckus?
Oh my gosh, the chaos that you see on boards. It could be anything. The stakes are so high. The number of zeros that follow some of these numbers are so large. Things get kind of crazy when there's that much money flowing around and that much influence, because OpenAI is an incredibly influential company. So I genuinely have no idea. Now, would I love to have been sitting in the boardroom and as a fly on the wall, or even better yet, as a board member? Absolutely. But I have no clue. There's so many ways that could have gone. I'm going to go with a genuine, I don't know.
No, I don't know. Yeah.
The most interesting thing to me, the most consequential thing that's going on in security right now, is the SEC court case against SolarWinds, if you've been tracking that. Specifically, the liability that the CISO of SolarWinds could find themselves under.
No, I haven't seen that. Personally liable?
Yeah, that's my understanding. And there's a very good amicus brief by Cooley and a few luminaries in the industry that talks about why this is a dangerous thing. I can send you a link to that brief when we hang up, and you can share it with the podcast if you like it. I think anybody who's a CISO is paying very close attention to that court case.
Yeah, that could have serious repercussions. I mean, a lot of people may just bow out of taking that job.
That's the sort of amicus brief's conclusion too, is that this may hurt public-private partnerships, may hurt threat sharing, and it may hurt people going, yeah, I'd like to sort of put myself in harm's
way. Yeah. I'd like to be liable for everything that's completely out of my control.
and where it gets interesting is D&O insurance wouldn't necessarily cover you, because it doesn't cover things that could be classed as fraudulent, right? It
just, yikes.
So it's complicated. I'm really interested to see what the court does in that story. And it's quite timely. The amicus brief only came out, I think, at the end of March. So, and it didn't really hit the news cycle. So I'm surprised by that. At least the brief didn't.
Yeah, I haven't heard about it. I mean, wow, that would be crushing. Because I do talk to a lot of CISOs, and they're under stress, you know, about...
CISO is one of the hardest jobs in the world, I think. I think they probably feel like the front end of a Volvo at times. They exist as like the crumple zone between them and the CEO.
Sometimes they're thinking like, hey, is this what I really want to do for the rest of my life? And they're asking me, hey, you got any consulting gigs, you know, something a little less stressful. You know, we start talking about money, and it's going to be hard to replace the salary to take a step down. So you got to ask yourself, is it really going to be worth it right now at this stage in your career? You got to hang in there. And I think a lot of people are having that same internal discussion with themselves, just in general, like, do I really want to be, if I imagine myself 10 years from now, do I want to be glued to computer screens for 8, 9, 10 hours a day for my job? You know, that's why a lot of folks are whatever, trying to be coaches and influencers, and or maybe going thinking about becoming a tradesman and becoming a plumber, working with their hands, a craftsman. You know, some of those trades are probably going to come back, because imagine myself 10 years from now, am I going to be sitting here just all day?
This is where we started, right? Do what you love and success will follow. And there's a lot of truth to that. Figure out what it is you love personally, and then figure out how to turn that into something that puts food on the table. And for me, it really is technology and security. So I'm very lucky. I've gotten to spend my entire career pretty much working on the topic I love. I think, you know, if you think about what makes somebody successful, it usually is that. And I think if you spend your life working on something you don't love, no matter how much money it brings you, did it really bring you success?
Yeah. Staring at computer screens all day, I don't love, but I do love the feeling of actually helping a company.
Got to feel good when you plug exactly the right candidate into exactly the right role. That's got to feel good.
Oh, yeah. That and getting people raises. I mean, that's my favorite thing. Help people get raises. I mean, my record is 110K.
My next gig. I mean, it's like, you're going to be right there with me, man.
Right. Yeah.
You'll be on my speed dial.
Right. Yeah. Nothing will make me happier than to, you know, help you land somewhere. But yeah. Well, hey, man, it's been fun. I'm so glad we had this conversation. And I'll be looking to you for any leadership advice now. And I look forward to following you as you write more articles, and I'm going to follow those as well. So yeah, it's been great, Richard. Thank you for joining.
I think, Blake, it's been really good fun, actually. And I've really enjoyed sort of hanging out with you for a while.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, you've been great to talk to.
Thanks a lot, Blake. Take care. Cheers.
All right. Take care, bud. Cheers.